Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, September 1st, 2015. At least one analyst says South Sudan's conflict can be linked to the large size of its army.
After the first year in power, there were 600 generals in the army. Can you imagine? That's more than the United States has. So all they cared about was money. And then, of course, they started fighting among themselves. And the poor people suffering more now than they did under the Sudanese regime.
And UNMISS is relocating foreign nationals away from its protection of civilian site in Juba.
The 510 foreign nationals who registered for the relocation program were given three options: a move to Juba town, a transfer to the Western Equatoria state capital of Yambio, or a move to the UNHCR-administered Makpandu refugee settlement.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Former U.S. Secretary of State for African Affairs, Herman Cohen, hopes the IGAD-mediated peace deal for South Sudan will lead to everlasting peace. He says many missteps along the way to peace must be corrected. He says a large UN peacekeeping force should be deployed to stabilize South Sudan, and technical experts are needed to help run key government departments. Cohen tells VOA's James Batty that some of South Sudan's problems can be blamed on colonial powers and on Khartoum.
They were not prepared because all of the colonial powers just totally ignored them. The British never did anything in the south. And when the Arab government in Khartoum became independent, they did nothing for the south. Just look at it. There's very few roads, very few institutions, very few clinics, very few schools. So I call South Sudan pre-colonial. So many African governments were able to benefit from contact with colonial power, sending their people to school in the UK and France, and they had people coming in doing good things. But South Sudan was zero. They got nothing from colonialism. So they started out really with not much. And unfortunately, the leadership that got elected really was the worst kind. They were very corrupt, and all they cared about was stealing money from the oil, and they did nothing for the people. Think of this. After the first year in power, the new government, there were 600 generals in the army. Can you imagine a small army in South Sudan with 600 generals? That's more than the United States has. So all they cared about was money. And then, of course, they started fighting among themselves. And the poor people are suffering more now than they did under the Sudanese regime.
Are you at all optimistic about this latest deal, of one of many which has been signed? And then, of course,
I pray to God at night that this deal will be upheld. But I'm very skeptical and pessimistic. It's the same people who are going to implement it. And some of the warlords already have said they're not part of it. I give you my solution, which nobody cares about, is the UN must come in there massively. They must bring in lots of blue helmets to give security to the people. That's first priority. Secondly, we have to do what we did in Namibia when they were becoming independent. Many civil servants came from New York to help them run government departments, run the treasury, run the budget, not just run it, but teach them how to do it. So after 18 months, the Namibians were ready to govern themselves. And this is what South Sudan needs.
President Salva Kiir repeatedly says that he was signing the agreement with reservations. And one of the reasons for his reservations has been the idea of giving up South Sudan's sovereignty. So if the UN sends troops there or peacekeepers there, wouldn't South Sudan be giving up its sovereignty?
Well, just temporarily, but he would still be president. He would still be making the major decisions. I'm not talking about people coming in and giving him orders, but people coming in and helping him to run the various departments, experts. That's what I'm not talking about, people who run things, but experts to help them run things.
That's Herman Cohen, former U.S. Assistant Secretary for African Affairs and author of the new book, The Minds of African Strongmen, Conversation with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figure. He was speaking to VOA's James Batty on Sunday. A police officer was killed and two civilians wounded in Mundri West County of Western Equatoria State last night. As VOA fellow Justin Tito reports from Washington, Western Equatoria Deputy Governor Sapana Abui says a manhunt is underway for unknown gunmen. VOA fellow Justin Tito reports from Washington.
The two civilians who were wounded are being treated in Lui Hospital. Their condition is unknown. Abui says the gunman simply walked into a local lodge in Mundir West where people were watching television and opened fire. He says the gunman was dressed in military uniform, but his identity is a mystery.
It was not known because it was late at night at about 10 o'clock local time. So under the cover of darkness, after shooting, he quickly just disappeared.
The killing of the policeman who was in the lodge at the time of the attack raises last month's death toll to 8 for the number of people murdered by unknown gunmen in the state. This includes the Speaker of the State Parliament, James Bagay-Lissa, and 6 other people who were gunned down and burned in their home last week in Yambio's Gagura Payam at night by unidentified gunmen. Last week, authorities in Western Equatoria State launched an investigation to find the killers of the Speaker and the 6 others. Abui says investigators are working from a list of alleged suspects, but he could not elaborate.
If the higher authority now to release is not at my level because it is a security and confidential report based on the findings of the committee. So it will be upon the higher authorities after the implementation, and then the outcomes will be made public to the people.
An eyewitness who prefers not to be identified or to have his voice recorded says the citizens of Mundir West fear their lives because the killers are still on the loose. Abui says authorities could track down the killers if the state were a more peaceful place. At the same time, he says the government is working hard to protect the citizens of Mundir West and the entire state.
But now that peace has been signed, it is our hope as the government of this state and South Sudan at large to control the use of guns and have proper laws in place so all these things will soon come to an end.
Abui says despite the recent killings, the security situation in the state is improving after what he calls 3 weeks of insecurity. Abui is urging citizens to work closely with the security officials to identify people who own guns illegally. He calls on all citizens to respect the law and the recently signed peace agreement by President Kiir and the rebel leader Riek Machar. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Washington.
From Yambia, we move to Juba, where the United Nations mission in South Sudan says it has begun relocating more than 500 foreign nationals from its protection of civilian site in Juba. The 2013 fighting in Juba triggered an influx of thousands of IDPs and foreign nationals, including refugees from Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia. Philip Thornaleu has more for VOA from Juba.
UNMISS spokesman Jose Contreras says more than 100 foreign nationals had already been relocated from the UNMISS POC along Ye Road to Juba Town late last week.
With the change in the security situation, there is no need for the foreign nationals to continue to reside in the UNMISS camp. UNMISS has worked with the foreign nationals, with relevant UN agencies, and also with national partners to identify other options for their continued stay in South Sudan.
Contreras says the UNMISS relocation program is being conducted in conjunction with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, and the International Organization for Migration. UNMISS also coordinates with the South Sudan's Commission for Refugees Affairs. Contreras stresses that the process is completely voluntary.
The 510 foreign nationals who registered for the relocation program were given 3 options from which to choose: a move to Juba Town, a transfer to the Western Equatoria State capital of Yambio, or a move to the UNHCR-administered Makpandu refugee settlement in Yambio. To date, 264 of them have made their selections, and 104 have voluntarily signed up for relocation to Yambio, which is expected to commence today, the 1st of September.
Some foreign nationals are seeking permanent refugee status. Their applications are being reviewed. Contreras says the relocation of individuals residing at UN camps is not connected to the recently signed peace deal to end the 20 months of conflict. But he says the relocation process may have a positive impact on South Sudanese.
If the relocation of these foreign nationals provides some sort of encouragement for South Sudanese internally displaced persons to leave our facilities voluntarily, then that is all to the good. However, this relocation program has absolutely no implications for the more than 200,000 internally displaced persons whom we are sheltering at six protection of civilian sites nationwide.
And Contreras says UNMISS will continue to fulfill its mandate of protecting civilians who are in imminent threats of physical danger in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonalew in Juba.
And now for some good news. Around 100 men and women who make a living fishing in the waters of the River Jure in western Bahr el-Ghazal state are learning a new skill that could boost their incomes and help to preserve the river environment. The technique they are learning uses special nets and allow fishermen and women to catch more quality fish than traditional method of using spears, nets, hooks, and poison. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from WOW.
Dominic John has been using a line and hook to fish for as long as he can remember, but he says traditional methods are less reliable than the new system that he and dozens of other men and women began learning yesterday.
Before, we were using hooks. Even we will not get a lot of fish. Even we will not get fish sometime even. But with net, I think daily you will get. With hooks, you will not get more fish. Even you will just get the one of your pot. You will not go to the market. If you will take it to the market, which means you have lose the one you have to eat. And if it is after this workshop, I think we will get more fish to sell in the market.
Rizik Peter of the Women's Development Group is one of the project coordinators for the workshops. Peter says it is vital to teach new fishing methods to locals because the old ways of catching fish are threatening to deplete river stocks in the near future.
The type of the net, they are now training. They cannot collect all the fish from the river. There is a certain type of the fish which need can be they can collect it to the market. As we have been seeing in the market nowadays, a very small fish has been taken to the market, which is not likable, which is just a waste. Waste to the resource, to our resource in the water. So we are training them. They will like that. We want to see into it that they know the type of the net they are now training in, and the time of the fishing is coming. It's starting from September going onward. You will see the type of the fish will, the quantity of the fish will be increased in the market. The quality, we need to have a very good quality of the fish in the market, not the smallest one.
The webbing on the nets that the Western Bahr el-Ghazal fishermen and women are being taught to fish will only allow fish of a certain size to be caught. There are rules in South Sudan that say that small fish should be thrown back into the water, but those rules are ignored and no one has ever been prosecuted for selling fish that have not yet reached maturity. It is widely felt that rather than imposing tougher laws on which fish can be included in a catch that is sold on the market, it would be more effective to teach fishermen new techniques and give them environmentally friendly equipment, like the nets they are being trained to use in WOW. Monica Emilio says she hopes to increase her income by using the new method of fishing. Emilio says with what she has learned at the workshop, she'll be able to repair her fishing nets and catch more fish. She says she will take her catch to market and sell, and with the money she makes, she will be able to feed her children and pay their school fee. Angelina Otimio says she is glad she has been trained in the new fishing methods because it could save her money. Otimio says now that she knows how to repair a net and fish with one, she won't need to buy fish from the market.
where fresh fish can cost up to 40 South Sudanese pounds per kilo. Otimio says she can't afford that, but with her new knowledge, she can go and fish for herself. Other fishermen say they are attending the workshop to learn to provide for themselves rather than accepting relief food from humanitarian agencies. Fisherman Lawrence Malok says humanitarian organizations should focus on teaching South Sudanese new skills instead of giving them food aid. He says having useful skills benefits the entire community rather than just the individual fisherman. In other words, as a medical philosopher once said, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, but teach him to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. The workshops are being funded by Italian non-governmental organization Manitese. The organizers expect to train 70 fishermen and 30 women in net fishing and equipment repair between now and Saturday when the workshops end. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting in WOW.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, do you know how long you will live? Stay tuned for an answer when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you been let down by someone you really trusted?
Yes, I've ever been let down by someone, and she was my friend, a lady. Yeah, once we got some misunderstandings with her, she revealed the secrets to the public. So, actually, it let me down. Yes, I felt much annoyed with her, and after all, we ended the relationship.
Yes, it's actually a cousin. I'd been helping to start up a business, so I gave them a loan, and they did not fulfill the payment schedule.
The friend I trusted most, he was a boy, but this man, he came to me and I borrowed him some money. But by the time goes on, I asked for that money, he refused to bring it back.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about living longer. There is both good news and bad news about life expectancy. The good news is people are living longer. The bad news is there is a bigger risk for poor health. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Around the world, life expectancy has risen by 6 years since 1990. A new study says much of that is due to advances against HIV/AIDS and malaria. In addition, progress has been made in reducing deaths from communicable diseases and maternal, newborn, and nutritional disorders. The top 10 places with the highest life expectancies are Japan, Singapore, Andorra, which is a microstate near Spain and France, Iceland, and Cyprus, followed by Israel, France, Italy, South Korea, and Canada. The U.S. ranks 34th in the World Health Organization's rankings for life expectancy. That's believed due to a wide range of health issues among a diverse population. Theo Voss is the lead author of the study. He's a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Voss says there's been a marked reduction in mortality rates from almost all causes.
Most importantly, all the infectious diseases that affect young children, the neonatal problems, so the problems following birth. But we've also seen very steady declines in injury deaths, and the rates of mortality from some of the big non-communicable diseases are slowly, or a bit more than slowly, declining as well.
For many, however, the quality of life in those extra years may be marred by health problems.
You increase the average lifespan of people, and with increasing age, you are more likely to get diseases that impair your ability to function. While we've been relatively successful at reducing the big causes of death, we've been less successful in making a dent in these causes of long-term disabilities.
Voss says some diseases and disabilities can be prevented, but he says investment in treating or curing them has not kept pace with investments for major diseases.
So we make a plea to medical research community to start thinking about investing more in those big causes of disability rather than mortality. And hopefully that will lead to some of the breakthroughs that we've seen that have led to the reduction in mortality.
9 out of the 10 countries with the lowest life expectancies are in sub-Saharan Africa. Lesotho is the worst, with a life expectancy of just 42 years. It's followed by Swaziland, Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau, and Zimbabwe, then Mozambique, Afghanistan, Chad, South Sudan, and Zambia.
Yeah, the big common threat there is the extent of the HIV epidemic. I actually worked for 10 years in Southern Africa myself, and I worked in Lesotho before HIV had affected the country. There were already a lot of poverty-related diseases.
Ischemic heart disease, a reduced blood flow to the heart, is the leading cause of what's officially known as DALY, or disability-adjusted life years. Number 2 is lower respiratory infection, followed by stroke, low back and neck pain, and road injuries. Then there are diarrheal diseases, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, also known as COPD, which includes chronic bronchitis and emphysema. There are also neonatal preterm birth complications and HIV/AIDS. And adding to the list, vision and hearing loss and mental health disorders. The findings are based on an analysis of all major diseases and injuries in 188 countries. Professor Voss says the goal is to find opportunities to improve health. He says the research will help shape the new Sustainable Development Goals that replace the Millennium Development Goals this year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And in more health news, a shortage of meningitis C vaccine is making it harder to combat an outbreak in Nigeria even before the traditional meningitis season hits in January. Already this year, there has been 12,000 cases and 800 deaths in Nigeria and Niger, according to the World Health Organization. Dr. Godswill Okara is the former head of Nigeria's Association of Medical Laboratory Scientists and current chairman of the West African Postgraduate College of Medical Laboratory Science. He tells Ricky Shirayak that Nigeria should once again start producing its own vaccine to stem future outbreaks.
We were producing some viral vaccines in the past. Curiously enough, the government of Nigeria, for one reason or the other, preferred to import vaccines rather than upgrade the facilities for production in Nigeria. For example, the vaccine production laboratory in Lagos was producing millions of doses of yellow fever vaccine and anti-rabies vaccine. So all of a sudden, the government abandoned the laboratory and went into dilapidation. As we speak, we import a lot of yellow fever and rabies vaccines into Nigeria from abroad.
Do you think if this vaccine laboratory was up and running, they could be making vaccine for meningitis C? Currently, there's an epidemic of this disease right now in Nigeria.
Certainly, if the laboratory is up and running, we'll be able to produce vaccine. As we speak, medical laboratory scientists are producing 18 different animal vaccines in the National Veterinary Research Institute in Nigeria. So if we can produce animal vaccines in export quantity, it's the same principle. It doesn't involve rocket science, something that we can produce human vaccines if the vaccine production laboratory were functional.
Do you think it's a question of funding or is it a question of just willpower?
It's a question of lack of political will. You know, during the oil boom in Nigeria in the 80s and part of 90s, they preferred to import virtually everything. hospitals. Even toothpick was imported into Nigeria. So as professionals, we feel very bad about it. The smallpox vaccine that was used in eradicating smallpox in the late 70s in Nigeria and in the West African sub-region was produced from the vaccine production lab in Lagos.
So not only could a vaccine production lab in Lagos potentially help this meningitis C outbreak, but do you think it could help other outbreaks, epidemics?
Yes, certainly. We have been advocating that there is need for Nigeria to produce meningitis vaccine since Nigeria is one of the 26 countries within the meningitis belt. Just as we produce millions of doses of smallpox vaccine for use in the West African sub-region, we can similarly produce meningitis vaccine for use in the entire meningitis belt in sub-Saharan Africa. Certainly, it will be much better to produce vaccines within the country using the serotype that is prevalent in the country, to use the indigenous strains that are causing outbreak disease in the country, rather than importing vaccines made with other strains that are possibly not indigenous to our country.
That's Dr. Godswill Okara, chairman of the West African Postgraduate College of Medical Laboratory Science, speaking to Ricky Shryock from southeastern Nigeria. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's news with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Herman Cohen says he hopes South Sudan's new peace agreement will lead to a lasting peace, but he is not optimistic. Cohen says a large U.N. peacekeeping force should be deployed in the country to stabilize it. He also says outside technical experts are needed to help run key departments such as the Ministry of Finance. Cohen says the country was not prepared to run its own affairs, and he says part of the blame for that lies with colonial powers. The United Nations mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, says it's relocating more than 500 foreign nationals from its protection of a civilian site in Juba. The fighting, which broke out in Juba in late 2013, led to an influx of thousands of IDPs and foreign nationals. UNMISS spokesman Joe Contreras says more than 100 foreign nationals have already been relocated from the UNMISS POC site along Ye Road in Juba Town to other locations. And finally, a Western Equatoria State police officer was killed and two civilians wounded in Mundri West County last night. Western Equatoria Deputy Governor Sapana Abui says a manhunt is underway for the unknown gunman. The two civilians are being treated in Louis Hospital for gunshot wounds. Abui says the gunman walked into a lodge where people were watching television and opened fire. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that's the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Nani Ongere by Colonel Mido. This one goes out to our listeners on 97.5 FM, Voice of Eastern Equatoria State in Torit.
Nani Ongere.
We've been listening to Colonel Mido with the song Nani Ongere. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Please join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nani olo tir, nani olong.